assist us, if you would, in watching some of the longer videos, length videos, which, you know, some of them are 3-4 minutes long and others are 3 hours. And so if you watch those, every like gives us a leg up on stepping up to the next level of operating on YouTube. And that means that the fact that 5 years ago we stopped traveling and that was a major source of our cash flow, if we get to a certain level and we're getting close to that, then YouTube becomes what they call monetized, and they start to pay us for our content rather than just giving them those hundreds of videos free. So if you'd like to help us with that, it would be nice to go and listen and like. Join the channel. And beyond that, we're honored that you're here. It's a privilege to continue conversation and to have so many different people's perspectives and inputs in winnowing our way through this Aramaic understanding and determining just what carries people into, out of the mindset of hostility and fear, the mindset of blame, into a mindset of connectedness, of responsibility, and perception based in, fueled by, the active presence of love. Remembering that whenever I, our core concept of the work, whenever I think or speak as though something outside of me is a cause of what's moving inside of me, I'm in denial. And when I enter denial, I dissociate from the content of my own mind. In other words, I hide the truth from myself. And when we do that, we live in a fantasy world. And of course, in that fantasy world, everybody else is the problem in our lives because we've hidden the real problem from ourselves. Well, Carl Jung talked about the shadow. And it's been referred to by many different names down through the ages. The shadow self, the shadow side. So when we refuse to deal with traumatic energies within us, then those energies that are hidden will come up and distort the perceptual mind. So the part of ourselves that we've cut ourselves off from, in turn, is projected into our brains. Dreams, fantasies of others. I remember working with a woman many years ago, and it was a real learning point for me as she shared what she discovered. And I certainly appreciate the discoveries that everybody shares with us in terms of doing one's work. But this woman was in an intimate situation with her husband. And she caught herself, because while she was in that intimate situation with her husband, she was fantasizing about another man. And the moment that she caught herself doing that, this is something she shared in a session to doing some forgiveness work around, the moment that she caught herself in that fantasy, she had such guilt that she instantly hid it from herself. But what she caught herself doing was, then her mind went to, oh, I wonder if my husband's cheating on me. And so when we deny something that's moving inside of us, that which we deny gets projected into our brain's images, dreams, fantasies, again, those three things, and they seem to be about others. Now, you remember when we're going through the Aramaic definitions, in that ancient Aramaic language, these aberrant states of mind, that when they are active, control attitude, words, emotions, perceptions, and behavior, they were called devan or demons. Now, the Greek had their own pantheon of demons, and they had people chasing these non-existent external creatures, and people are still doing it today. Oh, the devil made me do it. One gentleman I was working through something, he's just like, my family is under attack. And he starts to explain what's going on with mom, what's going on with dad, what's going on with him. And it's just, it's like your family isn't under attack, it's in denial. You've dissociated from the content of your own mind, so it's coming back to attack you, and you pretend that there's something out there that's there to get you. In Aramaic, it was the casting out of demons. You remember one in particular they talked about was this demon called fear. What do they say? Perfect love casts out fear. It wasn't about casting out these evil entities. It was about resolving the thought disorders in the mind, rather than thinking these projections of one's own dissociated mind were real external forces. So when we populate our perception with these constructs, these dissociated constructs, and in the ancient teachings, they called that mind the mind of man. When we populate it with false images, sometimes it's even diagnosed as PTSD, in order to scapegoat, pretend that others are the cause of what's moving in us, and bingo, what do we have? We have enemies. Now we hallucinate a world of enemies, and anyone who triggers what we don't want to deal with tends to become the enemy. Now, if I have the tools and I'm doing my work, and let's imagine somebody shows up. Let's give a list of descriptors of this person. This person's behavior was disgusting, nasty, wicked, horrible. You know, give it the whole realm of descriptors. And guess what? If you run into somebody who accurately, that's actually true about them, that's what you're doing. If you're functioning as a human being, if you're functioning as the created essence of love, you look at that and go, wow, that person's really got some stuff going on. But if you look at that person, or you think you're looking at that person, and all of a sudden you go nuts, oh, when they did that, they made me so angry, and they just enraged me. That's like, excuse me? No, if they are all those things you say they are, and you are functioning as a human being, and you look at them with a mind of compassion and love, period. However, if that person you give all those descriptors to, accurate or inaccurate, match what you've dissociated from in your own mind, then all of a sudden, the internal pain starts to move. Dissociated from the pain, I hallucinate a construct, a picture, that makes me believe that my pain is caused by something happening outside of me. So an antiquity experiencing through a mind filled with dissociated thought disorders was metaphorically described as seeing through as though through a glass darkly. It was spoken of as being lost in the desert. Some cultures, they call it the wolf, or the trickster, or the wily coyote. Different names they had for this hiding of one's own mind from oneself, never facing yourself directly. People who play this game think they can live a normal life and pretend there are no skeletons in their own closets. But these states of mind symbolize parts of ourselves that in most family systems have been disowned and kept in the dark. And when you realize the human mind is designed to be fueled by love, these dark, unresolved conflicts over generations become the root of perceptions, literally reflecting the mental illness of fear and hostility. So if someone does a behavior, and I label it, and I get into how it's all their fault, if I wake up from my own shadow, my own projection, I go, oh, I'm feeling this because, yes, that person did those, but let's say it's absolutely accurate that they actually did do those behaviors and they were just pure lowlife. Those behaviors will have no impact on you unless there's something in you based in lowlife energy. And if there is something in you based in that lowlife energy, then guess what? You resonate somebody in your space to do what you're hiding from yourself. And this is especially true, let's say, in relationship with children. You remember my favorite tongue-in-cheek line about children? Having a child is like having your unconscious mind hang out in true living color and Dolby sound. Everything you've never dealt with, they're going to bring up in you. They're going to play out. People come together in relationships not realizing that they're coming together through resonance, through their unconscious matching bags of garbage. Start out and they call their relationship a love relationship, and then they want to tear each other's eyeballs out when the honeymoon is over. That is, when each one has triggered what's in the other one that the other one doesn't want to deal with. And so, recognizing that if I'm standing in front of something that my mind says, this enrages me, that I have associated rage in my mind. That's my shadow. That's the part of me that unless I go directly inside, unless I have a technology, unless I know how to collapse the projected image on them and come back into direct relationship with my own shadow, my own dissociated side, I really believe that what I'm feeling is about them, when in fact, they've shown up in response to resonance, energy, resonate those things in me that I haven't dealt with. So I get the chance to move through them. And the purpose of life is to kick us right square in the limitation to show us what we're holding on to. So having a child that comes out of the same genetic structure you do, everything you've never dealt with is in their structure. Only they don't have a stop button. And all punishment on the part of a parent is an effort to wire in a stop button so the child will not do what resonates what's in the adult. If the child were going to do something that was out of line for the child, and it did not match anything in the adult would stand there as a state of active love. There would be no punishment involved in any way, shape, or form. There would simply be guidance given to the child. But the parent who goes into a rage and says, I'm only doing this because it hurts me more than it does you. I'm only doing it because I, quote unquote, love you. It's dealing with their own shadow projected into the brain image of the child. And then, of course, once you enter into a relationship, and, you know, one of the reasons, or the main reason why they warned us, those who understood how energy systems work, the reason they warned us about being promiscuous wasn't because of what genitals do. It was because each time you intercourse with someone, you exchange genes. Now they've got access to your unconscious mind. You've got access to theirs. And in that case, if either or both partners are not doing their work, they'll soon be singing the song of the honeymoon is over. And what's wrong with you? Look what you've done to me. You're the problem in my life. I never had any problems before I met you. Right. That is, you'd never looked at your shadow side until you found someone who matched it and resonated it for you. So the beauty of understanding that, the reason I'm talking about this is that when I run into someone who can show me that, and how do I tell whether it's mine or not? I'm the one who's feeling it. There's a little story that I haven't told for a long time that actually is one of Jeannie's favorite stories that I tell when I do workshops. And that's about the little old lady who loves movies. She loves to go to the theater. And she hears about this new film coming to town. She leaves home early. She's going to get there, get her front row seat. She's a little hard of hearing, doesn't see very well. But there's a traffic jam up and she gets lost, stuck in traffic. She ends up getting to the theater late and ends up with the last seat right in the very back of the theater. And there's this young couple sitting right in front of her. She's having trouble hearing and seeing anyway, and this young couple throughout the whole film is just laughing and talking, laughing hysterically. And finally, the little old lady reaches over and jabs this girl in the shoulder and says, "Young lady, are you feeling hysterical?" She kind of looks at the lady and says, well, he was feeling mine first. You can't feel anybody else's. If you're feeling it, it's not because that person is whatever your descriptors are, how terrible they are. Because that energy that you are feeling is being resonated in you. And the genius of this man, Yeshua, 2,000 years ago, to come along and explain all of that and show us specifically how to collapse the projected hidden parts of our minds, come back into direct relationship with the dissociated content, and bring it forward in the presence of love for healing is just monumental. As far as I know, there's nowhere else on the planet that it exists. There are philosophies, I know that, like the Buddhist philosophy, is very deeply into non-attachment. You know, don't be attached to outcomes, don't be attached to things. Several years ago, we ended up being invited to do a workshop at a center that was run by a gentleman who was a refugee from Tibet. He was a man who was considered to be the verified reincarnation of the Buddha of wisdom. And when I taught him the forgiveness worksheet, the forgiveness process, he's like, "Well, we have non-attachment, but we never had this thing of you cancel the goal in order to access your own hidden pain." And it's such a genius piece of information for people who are willing to do the work of healing. And so that's our a brief summation of what we're here to do. And delighted that you're here to lend an ear so that we can expand this energy out on a global scale. And Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
We do have a hand up. And in the chat room is Sean, and he had sent us an email, so we can address that later. But this is Bob. Okay. Welcome from Down Under.
Well, hey there, Bob. How are you doing, sir? Good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's good. And again, it's just synchronicity. It's 20 past three here in the morning. And my body woke me up. And I just logged, you know, got on the computer and you were live. And I thought, well, this is meant to be. So what I'd just like to do is talk to what you've been talking about, like fear and
great,
how it can drive you. And an update on my dance with prostate cancer.
And right.
Yeah. Well, when I realized that I had prostate cancer, I asked myself this question. Okay, Bob, you've created this event in your life. What's the lesson you need to learn from it? And almost immediately, I got back an answer from the universe saying, the universe said to me, Bob, it's time for you to put up or shut up. You either fall back into your old programming and go under the Western medical knife, or you walk your talk, which is nature is nurture, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. And you know, it's a sort of, yeah, okay, I got it. But I was still embodying a lot of fear around the word cancer, because both my parents died of it. And, And I think it's what drives a lot of people to actually take all these Western procedures. And what I realized was that for me, with my life experience, looking at the Western medical model, it is really, really focused on ameliorating the symptoms and they're not really interested in finding cures, because curing people is bad for business. And and all the procedures I've gone through recently, all the MRIs and CT scans and da-da-da-da-da, has been making money for somebody. Anyway, yesterday I had a call, originally had a PET scan, and it said, I've got a very aggressive form of prostate cancer, but it hasn't spread to the kidneys, liver, or bones, but it has escaped from the prostate. And so I had a call from the radiologist about, future treatments. And he was saying, they wanted to go in and burn all these tumors, and there was some in the lymph nodes and blah, 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 blah. And I just said, well, hang on a minute, bro. I'm the project manager of this particular exercise, and I've already, 6 weeks ago, I started my own natural healing protocol with things like chlorine dioxide and borax and baking soda and apricot kernels. And so what I want to do is see how that goes. So if you can recommend a test that I can measure my progress and see if it's successful, then we'll do that. And as soon as I said chlorine dioxide, he went, oh, but you're drinking bleach. And I said, no, no, mate. I've used this in the past. And since 2005, I've used chlorine dioxide when needed. And I said, do your own research and don't knock it till you've tried it. It's another example of these experts that focus on something so narrow that they're not aware of there's a great big world of other stuff out there. And these natural remedies have been around for centuries. So it was quite funny. And my closing comment to the guy was, well, he said, well, good luck, good luck with what you're doing. Maybe I'll see you again in the future. And I said, well, it'd be nice to have a chat with you, Tim, but I doubt if you will see me again in the future. Because one thing I realized was there was a phase in this little journey of mine where I was down in the dumps and going, oh, dear God, pity me, I've got cancer and blah, blah, blah. And then I just realized, well, hey, I'm bowing to the beast. I'm bowing to the beast. What I need to be is joyful and energized and ebullient and keep my energy up. And I am, I'm really looking at this as it's an exciting adventure, and I'm learning so much about how my body works, and my body is giving me great signs that I'm making progress. The chlorine dioxide is getting rid of something in my body, because I can see it in my urine. I can see cloudy deposits, and they're just the ash of the dead cells that the chlorine dioxide is destroying. And how else can I put it? I started taking chlorine dioxide baths, and all the purple blotches on my arms have gone. I had an ear infection for 6 months that wouldn't go, and that's disappeared, and my sinuses have all cleared up. So, it's an exciting journey. And
you're moving in the right direction.
Nice. The way I look at it, when I look at all the side effects that they list from the treatments they offered, like loss of muscle mass, decreased bone density, loss of cognitive function. Why would you? It's a no-brainer, and if I die, at least, I'm going to die under my own terms. But it's just reinforced my belief in me. And it's like, I've got to walk my own road on this one. So, and I've done it before, and I'll do it again. So that's where I am, and it was getting out of that.
Well, you're sending love in your direction, holding the space.
Yeah, well, it's great to be able to share this with you guys, because there aren't many people that listen to a crazy man like me.
Well, it doesn't sound crazy at all to me. My my younger brother, I think I shared with you before. I don't know whether you guys ever talked, but I think about 12 years ago, they gave him a year, and he's gone totally, completely natural right across the board, and he's still just rocking on and healthy. In fact, I talked to him the day before yesterday. They're getting ready to go on vacation to Scotland, and they told him 10 years ago he'd be dead, and he said, "Nah, I think I'll do this." And fortunately, he was, you know, the question you asked this gentleman about, well, have you got a test that will keep me on track? My brother fortunately did find a medical doctor who said to him, I don't agree with what you're doing at all, but I will, you know, be your caretaker here. I'll be your physician and keep you on track and keep testing to make sure you're moving in the right direction. And the guy has just been amazed. He's like, I can't believe my eyes, but you're doing it, you know? So that's been the result of his going. He's worked primarily with a naturopath, and it's been a pretty incredible journey for him.
Yeah, I tried to get hold of him. I phoned a couple of times, but I've had trouble with Skype. But one thing I've done with my GP and all these specialists that I've met, I've just reminded them that in this relationship, they are nothing more than hired contractors, and they don't like that. But that was the reminder. Yes, you know, you are specialists and you're very clever and all that. But actually, the contract between us is, I have hired you to provide me with data. Yeah, and that's sort of
right.
And it's true, isn't it? You know, I paid for their services.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In the early days of doing this work, excuse me, go ahead.
No, you're fine.
There's a bit of a delay. In the early days of doing this work, and many people who are on the radio show will remember Angie, who was, when I met her, a little Italian lady in her 70s. She had polio as a kid, had post-polio syndrome, and at one point she was on an examining table, and doctors examining her, and she's had a foot that was damaged from polio, and this woman's about, she was about maybe 4'10", just this little fireball of an Italian lady, and there were two doctors consulting, and they're standing there like she doesn't exist, like she isn't in the room, you know, like she's a lump of meat. So, well, I think what we'll do is we'll take off the front of her foot, and then just see how she progresses from there. And Angie got up off the table, kind of poked the guy, who, of course, being 4'10" or so, much bigger than she, poked the guy and said, when you get on the table and after they cut the front of your foot off, then you can cut the front of mine off, but not until. She walked out of his office.
Yes.
She was a pretty spunky little lady. And she outlived all of their predictions by a decade.
Yeah, and you know, for me, it's kind of sad that most people, you know, just fold into the fear and look to the doctors for their salvation. But for me, and I came across a strange statistic the other day from an American official organization. The biggest cause of death in America was medical intervention. So that says a lot, doesn't it?
That's right. Number three cause of death is properly prescribed medication and treatment. Okay. If that doesn't get your attention, you're not paying attention, right?
Yeah.
And it's tough. You know, the brainwashing in the culture with fear is so profoundly powerful, and it's definitely, you know, as I said earlier from the Aramaic, that it's literally, they said, perfect love casts out fear. It is literally, in the Aramaic sense of the word, demon, and not in the Greek sense. It's got all these little creatures running around chasing us, but those projections of our own minds, it's all an interesting wake-up call.
Yeah, but what struck me is one of my life principles is keep it simple, sovereign. Yeah, I know I changed it because I found that the words I choose to use create my reality. So keep it simple, sovereign. And then looking at all this stuff that they've been throwing me, it's just so complicated and complicated. And I thought, well, you know, this is all headspace stuff. It's not heart space. And now my solution is so simple. You know, it's chlorine dioxide, takes 5 minutes to prepare, cost me $30 for 3 months, you know, supply. And it's so simple. And the other thing I noticed, because I like delving back, was that the Rockefellers have been running or steering the Western medical model since the 1920s. You know? And they're not doing it out of love.
Report. Have you heard of the Flexner?
I have now. I'll do some research.
Yeah. Check it out. Yeah, Flexner was a minister, actually, that was hired by John Dee to go around and do a survey. Why he chose a minister, I don't know. He had no medical training, but he was sent around to assess the schools of medicine in America, which back then were primarily naturopathic and homeopathic, and basically wrote a report that with Rockefeller and his money, we're able to basically wipe out the idea of natural healing, and lo and behold, they just happen to have this company called Standard Oil, and they figured out how they could take these molecules of oil and turn them into things they called drugs, and it was worth billions to them, and you know now it's trillions, and the game goes on. But the Flexner report is pretty interesting to see the circumstances in which that was set up. It's pretty bizarre.
Well, what makes me giggle, in a sick way, I suppose, well, for one, we don't have a healthcare system. We have a disease management system. But to actually believe that by ingesting a chemical, a petrochemical, by its very nature is toxic, to believe that putting a toxin in your body is going to be good for you, that's, I don't know what, cognitive dissonance or insanity, I don't know.
Yeah, a little of both, I'd say. A little of both. And of course, that doesn't mean there's never a place for a drug. There are places where a drug can save a life. There's a difference between saving a life or eradicating symptoms and healing, unfortunately. And in many cases, the treatment can be, you know, supportive and assisting, especially if alongside of treatment is laid the healing option and people do their healing work.
I've got a classic example, quick one, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. But when I had my panic attack in November 1984, my body was thrashing around, you know, and I couldn't function in that state. So I went to the doctor and they put me on some benzodiazepines, Ativan, I think it was. And it should have been for 2 weeks, but it ended up being a 20-year cycle of antidepressants. Now, for 2 weeks would have been great because, you know, it sort of cut me off from those overwhelming feelings that I was having. And I was able to function.
Right.
But looking back at that event, it made me realize that what was frightening me was the actual power of these feelings that I was having and the power of the message that I was getting from my body. And then I realized that the power of those feelings was simply a measure of how powerful I am as a human being, as a spiritual being. So it's
right.
And it was through embracing those feelings and getting rid of the antidepressants, the long-term ones, that I actually was able to heal because it was through releasing those trapped feelings that I finally found healing.
Yep. You start to deal with your shadow, as we've been talking about. That's it. And most people want to pretend there's no such thing in me. You know, it's only they that have the shadow. Like, Right. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I've started a local support group aimed at suicide prevention, which I reckon is too little, too late. More focused on depression recovery, like get people, you know, before they get the knife out, and you know, just feeling a bit down, and yeah, and that's going good. It's called On the Mend, and we meet every Wednesday, and I do a Zoom Saturday. So yeah, and it's great. It's great. Yeah, I love it. Oh, I love being alive.
Well, I join you in being alive, extending love in your direction, and appreciate what you're doing to bring healing to the world. Bring your genius forward. And appreciate you sharing with us.
And thank you for sharing your platform with me. So that for me, every time I talk about what's going on for me, a little healing takes place, which is why I believe that simply by sharing our stories, we help to heal each other. So I treasure your presence in my life, and thank you very much.
Returned, absolutely returned. Are you familiar with a book called Illusions by Richard Bach?
I'd have to get a bigger sheet of paper.
It's a short book, and it's a quick read, a very entertaining read. Called Illusions, The Adventures of a Reluctant Messiah. And it's a story about a guy who basically is, you know, the Messiah, and he's a mechanic in, you know, some town in America, and how he deals with trauma around him. But one of the lines in the book, it's written by Richard Bach, is that we teach best that which we most need to learn. So here we are doing it.
Yeah,
teach what we need to learn. So, honored and delighted to be sharing the planet with you, sir.
Thank you so much for being there.
All right. Appreciate your laugh. Have a blessed one. There you go. Yeah, that's it. All right. Yeah. Take care. Blessings. Okay. Bye bye.
Cheers.
Cheers. Sweet. Well, Miss Jeannie?
We do not have another hand up, so let's address Sean's question.
Yes.
So I'd sent that to you. Do you want me to read it, or?
Sure, go ahead and read it. I'll go ahead and look it up on my email as well.
Okay. So, and I'm not sure, but the way that I read it, there may be a little mix up on, you know, let me read the question. I was trying to get the concept of the two mind filters. Can they also be called spirits? Like when Jesus said, we don't know what spirit we are of. One of the unconscious and the other of the conscious, right? One controls the goal's output and the other only allows certain goals. Is that right? I feel like if I can get this concept internalized, it would help me to identify other processes. With most things Michael talks about, I can see a church equivalent, but I do see his chemistry and thought pattern way of teaching is the actual, quote, how it works, unquote, of what the Christians claim they know. On my own, I began to research the concept of Satan and prayer. Praying helps put the mind in the correct mode, I believe. I don't really think there are angels that carry our English words back and forth to God. Are there angels in some kind of capacity, or is that a misconception also? And so I can see the three filters, you know, that are over the perception and intentions, but then there's also the conscious, unconscious, and subconscious. So they're two different things.
Well, several things, Sean, that you trigger with these ideas, with this writing. One, in Aramaic, and I don't know if you've been on a show where we talked about this, but the word prayer in Aramaic has nothing to do with putting our order into the cosmic gift catalog. the word actually means to set a trap for God, God being love, and recognizing from a physics perspective that, you know, I have a TV antenna on my roof, and if that antenna is the right shape, the arms are the right length, and they're oriented properly, then that antenna is a trap that captures the signal from channel 2 that I then get to watch on my TV. I get a beautiful picture and sound. If somebody goes up on the antenna and bends the arms and turns the antenna backward, my beautiful signal is going to disappear and I'm going to get some kind of mess in my TV. So the antenna is a trap or a frequency. When the disciples said to Yeshua, teach us to pray, they were asking about something they did not understand. And of course, he didn't say a prayer. What's called the Lord's Prayer is not a prayer, it's a set of instructions. And the instructions are, here's how you align and orient yourself so that you fulfill your role as a true human being, where you live, move, and have your being in this energy field called love, and being oriented and aligned properly, you capture or you trap that energy and you reflect it into the world. That's the meaning of the word prayer. In Aramaic, my best understanding of the word angel is that angel is thoughts from the Creator, literally mind energy directly transmitted to us from the Creator, that we're capable of capturing that. And that, so angelic thoughts would be thoughts that would be connected to the active presence of love. So the two filters, actually there are three filters over the frontal lobes of the brain and three filters over the back. They're matching. And the three filters are, and we've talked often about RACHNA. RACHNA is a filter over the frontal lobes of the brain that is also a gateway. One, it's a gateway for love, our human essence, to enter our human forms. There are lots of people running around that there is no human life in them because that gateway is closed. They are human, but in terms of function, that human, that presence of active love doesn't enter them because that gateway is closed. That's the first function of RACHNA, as a gateway. And then its function as a filter is over the frontal lobes of the brain, so that only intentions, in the frontal lobes of the brain, intentions are stored. Only intentions key to love can pass through that filter. The other two qualities of intentions that can be held in the mind are those which are negative or destructive. There are three filters, and each filter, when active, excludes the output of the other two. So in RACHNA, love, that filter is active. Only units of energy or information key to intentions that are in harmony with love will become available. If fear is active, then only destructive intentions become available. If hostility is active, then only, pardon me, I got that reversed. If hostility is active, destructive intentions. If fear is active, negative intentions. So there are three qualities of intentions: destructive, negative, and those key to love. RACHNA being active allows only those that are key to love to be passed to the mind, to be used as raw material for goals. And there's a schematic that we have in the mind that gives you a visual of this. Jeannie's probably already put it in the notes, but if she would, so you can grab it there. And once our intentions are established, based in love, being the raw material of goals, we select from a variety of intentions, and when we choose one to commit to, we actually change the intention into a goal. And goals in the human mind are what drive perception. That's why the forgiveness process is so intimately connected with goals. Because if I set a goal and someone violates it, and that goal relates in the perceptual part of the mind to some form of hostility or fear, then even a goal key to love can trigger hostility or fear, i.e., the person who, when the parent was whipping them, is told, I'm only doing this because I love you. In the child's mind, that definition of love becomes being whipped. So there's a corollary filter over perception, which is at the base of the brain. Three matching filters. The one that, in Aramaic, the word for the filter that relates to love over perception is kuba. The two filters, rachma and kuba, together are what we're called perfect love. And that's what they said, cast out fear. In other words, when rachma and kuba are active, anything based in a fear energy is excluded from the mind. It's removed. The other two filters over perception are, again, hostility and fear. If hostility is active, then one is going to be irritated no matter what the object of attention is. And we have a saying in this culture that relates to that, he got out of bed on the wrong side this morning. What does he mean? That means he's got the hostility filter active in his mind. No matter what he looks at, the data in his mind is filled with irritation, so he's going to be, quote-unquote, irritated by that. His projection that the irritation is outside rather than inside. If fear is the active filter, then the only perceptual quality that the mind can generate is that of something threatening. So the filters are designed to determine the quality of raw data available for intentions, and then the quality of output energy that upon which our perceptions are based. So you could speak of them as spirits if you're living in the spirit of fear, or if the spirit of love has captured you. Yeah, I think that would be a very appropriate way to say it. And then, as Jeannie said, the conscious and unconscious, the next idea that you have here, one is of the conscious and the other is the unconscious. Not really, no. It is a separate thing. So these filters are operative on qualities of information that move. The conscious, unconscious, we're now talking about literally information that's stored in the mind. And you know, there's only, when we're referring to this, what we call the mind, and actually it truly isn't the mind, but what we call the mind is simply the action of the movement of energy in brain cells. And there are three levels or amplitudes at which that energy can move. You know, if I say don't think about the color of your car, I just added some energy through resonance through your ear into your brain, and something resonates about the color of your car. So, in effect, what I did was added energy or turned up the amplitude of the brain cells you have relating to the color of your car. And if I said, what's your favorite item of clothing? I just resonated a different set of brain cells, and now those brain cells come to the conscious level. A moment ago, they were subconscious. And notice, as you're thinking about, you know, your favorite item of clothing, nothing about the color of your car is moving. And so the brain cells that were amplified a moment ago by my statement, don't think about the color of your car, recede back to the subconscious level as the brain cells about your favorite item of clothing. What's the front door of your house look like? Visualize in full color and detail what the front door of your house looks like. That's information that's stored in the subconscious mind. And I, with my question, resonate those brain cells, and the subconscious becomes conscious. The color of your car becomes subconscious. So conscious and subconscious are always changing places. The filters impact what qualities of information are allowed to come to awareness in response to stimulus, like what's the color of your car or the front door of your house look like. And then those who live in denial and dissociation, those who live in a world where they say, you made me mad, in order to believe that something outside of me is the cause of mad inside of me or anger, I literally have to hallucinate a lie that shows me that something outside of me is the cause of what's moving inside of me. And so I have to hide or dissociate from those brain cells that contain anger. And therefore, I've created an artificial condition for myself as a human being, and I have now an unconscious mind, something that I have difficulty or cannot access. And so I usually demonstrate that one by just asking people the question. So what is it that is the biggest challenging, like the thing that's the most traumatic thing that you need to work through? What is it that you really need to go for and move through? And then notice what's happening with your breath. And for most people, when they're asked that question, they stop breathing because that's unconscious. And the way they keep information from firing at an amplitude strong enough to become consciously aware of it, they hold the breath. That allows us to hide things from ourselves and create this unnatural, unconscious condition. So the filtering system filters things on all levels, conscious, subconscious, unconscious. So they'd be two separate, totally separate things would be my take. And so I hope that makes sense. You know, when they said take care of the heart, for out of it are the issues in life, they were saying take care of the unconscious, take care of what you're hiding from yourself.
He said,
and I'm just reading through the rest of your note.
He says, Michael needs to convert this to a newsletter. This is the fulfillment of what Jesus came to teach about love and living in the body and beyond. But he had to wait for all of us to catch up. The farmers and fishermen could never understand. It wasn't their fault. It would be like explaining a starship to the founding fathers. And I did put a link to the filters in the notes for today.
And then one other word that you mentioned is that word Satan. And in Aramaic, Satan means the resistor, one who misleads. It's got nothing to do with the externalization to some evil entity out there that's out there to get us. And we can verify that very easily by going to the events that happened just after the Garden of Gethsemane when Yeshua comes out. And there's Peter. He's just, you know, activated his sword, attacking the high priest servant. And Yeshua directly confronts him and calls him Satan. And then he explains exactly what the Aramaic word is. It's interesting how the mind can bypass this. I mean, he very clearly addresses Peter as Satan. Actually had this conversation with someone back a couple of months ago, and they were saying, oh, no, he wasn't calling Peter Satan. He was addressing, Satan was inhabiting Peter, and he was addressing Satan, the evil dude with the red suit, the tail on the pitchfork. Like, no, he's straight up calling Peter Satan, and then he says why he's calling him that. And it's got nothing to do with this dude with the red suit, the tail on the pitchfork. He says, for you think in the mind of man rather than the plan of God. You're stuck in carbon-based memory. You're stuck in perception, and you're resisting the truth. If you were to be able to tune into the actuality of this moment, you would know that I have set up this whole scenario that's about to unfold to demonstrate a principle to the world. And here you are trying to stop it. Get thee behind me, Satan. Like, get out of the way. You're not going to stop this thing. This is what I came to do. Interestingly enough, if you listen to the words, and it's interesting how so many Greek scholars will tell us it was all written in Greek to begin with. But interestingly enough, there are some of the final words from the cross, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, and we're told that was left in the original Aramaic. Well, if it was left in the original Aramaic, then obviously the original was Aramaic. And what does it mean? Has he been abandoned by the Creator? Well, wait a minute. Here's the Creator hanging on a cross, abandoned by the Creator. That's all Greek to me. No. The words Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani are a greeting to his Father, to our Father, saying, I got it. I understand why you reserved me for this. Abandoned in Aramaic is similar to represent being being set aside for a special purpose. So what Yeshua was saying was, oh, not you've abandoned me, but oh, I got that you sent me aside for this special purpose. I'm not buying into the hostility, the fear, the pain, the trauma. I'm staying conscious as the presence of active love. So they can kill my form, but they can't touch me. My awareness is not dependent on my form. And give me 3 days and I'll rebuild it. And it all fits and just starts to make sense. So that would be my my thoughts. And if there's any other interaction, you're in the chat room, so if, as I understood it. So are there any other thoughts? Does that fit and make sense?
While we're waiting on him to respond, we only have 3 minutes, but we have a hand up.
Okay, let's go for it.
All right, Rex, 517, you're on the air.
Hey, young man, welcome. How are you doing? Hello, Rex. Are you muted, Rex? See there, Jeannie?
Yes, I was muted.
Oh, there you are. Yep.
Okay, so that took a minute. All right. So, yes, that's been great. Thank you. No, that had nothing to do with technology. It had everything to do with me in the moment. Just not doing correctly. But that being said, I was teaching a class called Laws of Living at Unity Church, and I had 6 students. And this was many years ago, and everybody knows the laws of living. I was saying that with tongue in cheek, but I was sharing what you were just talking about, and all of a sudden I had a sensation at the time. It was a feeling of knowing Yeshua, and when he was on the cross, and I just put my arms out and I said, you know, and he was there as explaining it. And all of a sudden, that was an overwhelming feeling and sensation of being Yeshua, although I knew I wasn't. I was tuning into that frequency, I would suggest, and that vibration. And the very things that were said, for this you have set me aside, is what I remembered seeing. But it came across so clearly with this remarkable awe, Michael, of what that actually meant. And you just resonated it, and I wanted to share that.
Cool. Yeah, that would be it exactly. I think it was a moment for him of, up to that point, it was cooperation with the plan and being part of the source of the plan, though perhaps not really fully understanding it until that moment. And then it was like, oh, I got it. Yes.
Yeah.
I've been reserved to demonstrate this. What a privilege.
Tremendous. Awesome, brother. Thank you for allowing me.
All right, sweet. Have a blessed one. All right, lots of love. Blessings. Everybody, thank you for joining us. Create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world.